very different economic and political vision for the islands that is really grounded in deep sovereignty. So not only political sovereignty, but food sovereignty, water sovereignty, energy sovereignty, a transition and a response to Maria that treats it like the wake-up call that it should be, so that the way in which Puerto Rico recovers actually get at the root causes for its vulnerability. So that
we want to thank you, Naomi, for being with us. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at PCC Cascade in Portland. Kathy will speak on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, finding hope in countries devastated by U.S. policy. Her particular focus helps expose the direct impacts of U.S. policies, including sanctions, war, drones, and military support for warring parties. Again, that's Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Eco Film Festival, taking place September 27th through 30th at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. The Portland Eco Film Festival is the premier environmental film festival in the U.S. Pacific Northwest. This year, the festival will screen the films The Beaver Believers, Dirt Rich, The Kingdom, How Fungi Made the World, B-Sharp Honeybee, and Elephant Path. Again, that's the Portland Eco Film Festival, taking place September 27th through 30th at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. The time is 5:02, and the KBOO Evening News is next. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708. And now, the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland has reached a settlement on sidewalk accessibility.
Bill Cosby has been sentenced for sexual assault crimes.
And in international news, the Swedish Prime Minister has been ousted by a parliamentary vote of no confidence. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 25th, 2018. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. A federal judge has given final approval to a $113 million settlement with the City of Portland to install or improve around 18,000 curb ramps on city streets over the next 12 years. In this plan, the city will install or repair 1,500 curb ramps annually. This nearly doubles the 750 ramps worked on per year currently. Three plaintiffs with mobility disabilities argued for equal access to public rights-of-way for users of wheelchairs, scooters, canes, or walkers. Their attorney, Linda M. Dardarian, said the settlement will give alter-abled people, quote, the freedom to move around the city. This case began after the plaintiff sent a letter to the City of Portland in July of 2016 that alleged it lacked adequate curb ramps to comply with the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. The city will now install ramps during other construction projects on roads or sidewalks and upgrade other curb ramps that are not accessible. The city will also hire new ADA technical advisors within the Bureau of Transportation. Curb ramps near government offices, schools, medical facilities, assisted living homes, and in residential neighborhoods are first priority. The city will also be required to report its progress by the end of the second quarter each year.
Bill Cosby has been sentenced to 3 to 10 years in prison for sexual assault. Cosby was convicted in April of aggravated indecent assault and declined to speak to the court prior to sentencing. Judge Stephen T. O'Neill said, quote, "Nobody is above the law because of where they live, who they are, wealth, fame, celebrity, or even philanthropy." Cosby was sentenced to a time in state prison for drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Costand in her home 14 years ago. The actor and comedian will also be required to pay $25,000 as well as the costs of prosecution. He will be held in confinement in a state facility and will be required to take a sex offenders program. Cosby will also be classified as a sexually violent predator, which requires a lifetime registration and sex offender counseling. The defense motioned for a discretionary release on bail, but the judge denied the application due to the seriousness of the crime. Cosby was booked into Montgomery County Correctional Facility and will be temporarily transferred to SCI Phoenix, a state prison in Pennsylvania. According to Amy Warden, a spokesperson for Pennsylvania Department of Corrections, Cosby will be processed the same as any other inmate.
Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven lost a no-confidence vote in Parliament on Tuesday, essentially being ousted from his position. Löfven heads the center-left Social Democrats Party and has been Prime Minister of Sweden since 2014. In the no-confidence vote, 204 parliamentarians voted against him, while 142 voted for him and 3 abstained. In current talks, anti-immigration Sweden Democrats are threatening to block any new government unless they are given a say in policy. The Sweden Democrats Party has its roots in the white supremacist fringe movement. The rise of the far right in Europe has forced many traditional parties to share power or reach out to other opponents. Sweden's center-left and center-right blocs are now evenly balanced after the September 9th election. Löfven's center-left bloc won 144 seats in the election, just one more than the center-right opposition alliance. The far-right Sweden Democrats won 62 seats. A new government could take weeks or months to develop, and the parliament speaker will begin discussions with party leaders on Thursday.
And now it's time for Labor History in Two, presented by Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1961. That was the day when Herbert Lee was murdered just outside of Liberty, Mississippi. He was a successful black cotton farmer who became active in efforts to register black voters. Lee had 9 children. He was one of the few area black farmers with a vehicle. This made him very valuable to the voter registration movement. Lee would drive Bob Moses from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee around Amet County to reach unregistered voters. It was dangerous work to register black sharecroppers and farmers in rural Mississippi. Attempts by black residents to gain legal or economic equality were met with threats and violence. On the morning of his murder, Lee had come to the Westbrook Cotton Gin just outside of Liberty to drop off a truckload of cotton. There, he was met by a childhood friend, Mississippi State Representative E.H. Hurst. Hurst came up to the truck and started shouting at Lee. Then he took out a gun and shot Herbert Lee in the head. Witnesses stated that Lee had brandished a tire iron at Hurst. Hurst claimed self-defense. A jury declared the murder was justifiable homicide. Lewis Allen, a black farmer and timber worker, was one who had testified about witnessing the shooting. Later, he recanted his testimony, saying that he had lied about Lee threatening Hurst because he feared for his life. After Allen began to talk about what he actually saw that day, he became the victim of harassment and beatings. Finally, on January 31st, 1964, he too was gunned down in his driveway. No one was ever convicted or even arrested for his murder.
Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
In September of 2012, an investigation by the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice found that police brutality was a systemic problem within the Portland Police Bureau. The findings letter that investigators sent to then-Mayor Sam Adams noted that they, quote, found instances that support a pattern of dangerous uses of force against persons who posed little or no threat and who could not, as a result of their mental illness, comply with officers' commands. Following the investigation, the DOJ sued the City of Portland, and in 2014, a settlement agreement was reached that outlined a series of training, reporting, and use of force reforms that had to be implemented within 5 years. In anticipation of the settlement provisions expiring in the coming year, the Portland Police Bureau has begun the process of drawing up what they call a strategic plan. They have set out to get community feedback in a variety of formats, one of which is community forums. KBU reporter Jasmine Moneymaker has this report.
On a recent September evening, about 50 Portlanders gathered in the auditorium of the Matt Dishman Community Center in Northeast Portland. They were there for the second of two community forums organized to collect public comments for the Portland Police Bureau's five-year strategic plan.
So here's the meeting format. Facilitators at the table, can you please raise your hand? Now, you better give these individuals your utmost respect, right? Because the police is here, right? These are the people who are going to listen to you and take your notes.
As the night got underway, participants moved from table to table to share their opinions on three topics: crime reduction and prevention, community engagement and inclusion, and organizational excellence within the Portland Police Bureau. Facilitators from the Bureau took notes while people offered frank assessments of the problems they saw within the Bureau. One retired homicide detective and his wife spoke of the risks of ignoring officer well-being and mental health.
Police officers have to be supported when they deal with alcohol, drug addiction, because they do, unhealthy relationships. The code of silence is so strong that police officers don't feel confident enough to ask for help, and they don't get help. And then they experience burnout, and they internalize, and then they act out in a bad way on sometimes on citizens, you know, when they're arresting people.
After 15 years, you're sick of it. You're sick of the job after 15 years. And if you have to keep coming to work, you're not doing so in the interest of the citizen. You're just, I'm here now for my pension. I don't care what happens to you. So
the conversation around community engagement and inclusion highlighted the need for more diverse officers who are truly engaged with the communities they serve. One commenter, who was wearing her Guardian Angel uniform, echoed the comments of many others at the table when she called for more understanding of diverse communities and the need for meaningful relationship building.
I think it's really important that when, especially when we come to other nationalities or other officers from different ethnic backgrounds, that when they go into a community that's predominantly one specific background, they understand the culture of that background. They understand how we operate, how we do things, so that even though they have their preconceived ideas, they need to let that go and really delve in and understand the community, which is going to other events, not just crime prevention events, but church events, picnics, public events, and not just doing security, but engagement.
At the crime reduction and prevention table, participant comments highlighted the sometimes conflicting nature of community concerns, with some focusing on broken windows, others broken trust, and still others advocating for a redefinition of crime.
So we're going to focus this conversation on your priorities. So think about your priorities around crime reduction and prevention.
My priority is reducing white-collar crime, landlords, pollution, prison slavery, corruption. I think we're wasting too much time going after the poor and the blacks, and not enough over those who do the most harm to society.
What else?
On a more simplified term, just communities working together and with the police within their community to create safer communities for everybody.
I feel like there's a huge need for an emphasis on code enforcement. Clutter, darkness, and grime are the things that hide crime. It makes it really easy to make a drug deal. If you're able to get rid of junk cars that are blocking up parts of the streets, put up lights, you can make areas a lot nicer without having to actually have a show of force of any kind.
priority for me is because I'm physically disabled, I use public transit all the time, and I really want demilitarization of police or demilitarization of presence on the MACs.
What else?
Well, one thing we haven't even talked about is demonstrations. My concern is the equivalency that Portland police place on neo-Nazi demonstrators having the right to do their thing and condemning the counter-protesters, who I think represent the mainstream. But I think that provokes a tremendous amount of ill will in communities where people feel there is no equivalency between neo-Nazism and hate crime and, you know, the counter-protesters who come out to protest them. But the police try to treat it as if they're somehow equal and that the Nazis have the same rights as everybody else. Or more. And actually, or more. That's the part that's got my family concerned.
What else?
Profiling. If you profile me and I feel like you profile me because I'm African American, or I see you profile other people, I'm not going to call you if I see a crime because my fear is that somebody will be killed.
The forum closed with a brief Q&A session in which one of the participants asked about the Caraggio Group, the consulting firm that was hired on to assist the Portland Police Bureau in this data collection or feedback collection process.
I think Chris indicated that we have a great consultant. Is the consultant a part of the community, or is the consultant outside of the community? I mean, from another state or so forth.
No, the consultant's here in Portland. They're a local group. Their name is Caraggio.
A reflection of the community.
It's a little hard to hear, but what she asked at the end was whether the group was a reflection of the community. And we think it's important to note that the answer to that question is no. The Caraggio Group has worked on many projects for city and county governments on the West Coast. And while researching the Portland-based consulting firm, KABU noticed that all the staff pictured on their website were white. When we called the group to ask about the makeup of their staff, one of their principals declined to comment and referred us to Assistant Chief Chris Davis, the project lead within the police bureau. A.C. Davis told KABU that he was unaware of any people of color working for the Caraggio Group and said that it was his understanding that another firm, JLA Public Involvement, had been subcontracted to, quote, make up for that gap. JLA is a more diverse firm, according to their founder, Gene Lawson, who told KABU that women of color make up about 30% of her staff. But JLA is overseeing just one part of the complex and widespread feedback collection process. That's the 15 invite-only community focus groups. The Caraggio Group facilitators are responsible for everything else. That means they're the ones conducting 40 one-on-one interviews, 4 bureau focus groups, the community and staff surveys, and the 2 community forums. Asked if he thought diversity was important in this process, A.C. Davis said he considered diversity to be important in any endeavor, and that while the Caraggio Group was facilitating the process, the plan ultimately did not belong to them. He said, quote, the plan is ours, the city of Portland, and the community, end quote. If you are a member of the Portland community and were unable to attend either of the 2 community forums, you can still contribute your thoughts on the future of the Portland Police Bureau by submitting a comment card at any police station or by submitting feedback on the strategic plan page of the Portland Police Bureau website. This is Jasmine Moneymaker for KBOO News.
Tomorrow, the Portland City Council will be formally appointing members to the new Portland Committee for Community Engaged Policing, or PCEP for short. 13 Portlanders will be confirmed after a months-long rollout overseen by the mayor's office. Technically, they are being appointed for 2-year terms, although 5 of the first crop of appointees are being given 1-year terms, so the turnover will be staggered. The appointees include 2 high school students, 2 peer support specialists from the mental health community, a county social worker, a Rosemary Anderson High School teacher, and other active community members. Also involved is a general manager of the Lloyd Center, the current policy manager for Airbnb in Portland, and Sam Sachs, a former law enforcement officer who runs Breaking Bread with Police dinners in Portland. In comments submitted to the mayor's office, Portland Cop Watch noticed that no mention has been made of any alternates. The PCEP is the city's attempt to replace the Community Oversight Advisory Board, or COAB, a community oversight body acquired by the city's settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Cop Watch noticed that COAB, quote, burned through all five of its alternates within a year. Before the city declined to fill its empty seats and the committee effectively stopped existing. On October 4th, a federal judge will hold a hearing to assess the city's compliance with the settlement agreement. It remains to be seen how the judge will view the year-and-a-half-long absence of a citizen-led committee to oversee the city's implementation of the settlement. Stay tuned to the KBOO Evening News tomorrow and over the next coming weeks for community-based coverage of the rollout of the PSEP and the fate of the settlement.
Judge Brett Kavanaugh, who is increasingly beset by accusations that he sexually assaulted women in high school and college, will appear before the Senate for further confirmation hearings this coming Thursday. He is now facing a second and possible third accuser, but the Thursday hearing will only involve Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, a research psychologist in California, who has said that Kavanaugh attempted to rape her at an off-campus party when she was only 15. Deborah Ramirez, who has also brought forth accusations against Kavanaugh, is being asked by committee lawyers as to whether she has any additional evidence. The scene has led to comparisons to the confirmation hearings for Justice Clarence Thomas 27 years ago, in which Anita Hill accused then-would-be justice of inappropriate sexual aggression. Speaking on NPR, Hill said this week that the hearing with Blasey Ford on Thursday, quote, cannot be fair and thorough. She said that the hearing, as it is configured, cannot provide the senators with, quote, enough information to reach a reasonable conclusion. The Democrat and Republican members of the committee do not agree on whether a second accuser should be included in the hearing. Kavanaugh, meanwhile, has appeared on Fox News to deny the accusations. He said, quote, the truth is, I've never sexually assaulted anyone in high school or otherwise. I am not questioning and have not questioned that perhaps Dr. Ford at some point in her life was sexually assaulted by someone at some place, but what I know is I've never sexually assaulted anyone. The chairman of the committee confirmed Tuesday that the panel has hired an outside counsel, widely believed to be a female attorney, to question Brett Kavanaugh and the woman who accuses him of attempted rape. Anticipating the hearing, hundreds of women protested outside Capitol Hill yesterday, and 128 were arrested. They are calling for demonstrations nationwide this Thursday, asking protesters to wear black and write, I believe, on their palms.
A new report says investing in programs for young parents is essential to helping them succeed. KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu has the story in collaboration with Eric Tegethoff of the Oregon News Service.
Financially secure Oregonians, but the hardships can be even greater for young parents. A report out today, Tuesday, by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, called Opening Doors for Young Parents, stresses the need for increased programs to support people between the ages of 18 and 24 who have children. Tonya Hunt, head of Children First for Oregon, says making sure young parents stay in school or successfully enter the workforce helps their children too.
You get this two-generation benefit. We're not only helping those young parents be successful in their start to adulthood, but we're also really stabilizing and helping those young children that they're parenting and getting them off on the right foot.
The report finds about 33,000 Oregon children have young parents, and 72% of those children live in low-income families, above the national average of 69%. Additionally, only 10% of these parents have an associate degree or higher, and 40% are people of color. The report recommends states provide increased access to childcare, housing, and employment opportunities. Rosa Marie Castaneda with the Casey Foundation says families sustaining jobs increasingly require post-secondary education and specialized skills, but young parents who have limited resources are unable to stay competitive in this workforce landscape. She says apprenticeship programs, career programs, and post-secondary education are a boost for earning power and in getting high-quality jobs.
Young parents have less access to these, and they're less able to participate in these programs and not get their education disrupted because they're having some challenges just meeting some basic needs.
The report also highlights the importance of home visiting programs and access to health care. Children are more likely to have coverage if their parents are insured. This is Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
The people, we are the people, and who are the people? All the people, and we walk the road together, and we walk down the road.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference, then at 7, calculated conversation. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 84 degrees. Today in history, in 1957, the Little Rock Nine entered Central High School under heavily armed guard. Troops remained at the school throughout the year, but the black students were still subjected to verbal and physical assaults from other white students. The quote of the day is from one of the Little Rock Nine, Terrence Roberts, who said, quote, "In Little Rock, every possible decision had a racial component. Where you could live, where you could go to school, whether you could work or not, whether you could get a bank loan, who you could marry. This made no sense to me, especially as I discovered there is no such thing as race."
And now, from the Yale Center for Environmental Communication, it's Climate Connections. On today's episode, a few degrees of warming makes a big difference to bees in the Arizona desert.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Across the western U.S., a shiny green bee pollinates manzanita shrubs and overwinters in the boreholes of trees. But warming temperatures could make it harder for this species, Osmia ribiflorus, to survive in parts of its native range.
In already warm ecosystems like deserts, a lot of organisms may be close to their physiological limits. You warm up the temperature, and they don't really have a lot of room to adjust.
Paul Caradonna of the Chicago Botanic Gardens tested the effect of warming on these bees in Arizona. He painted nesting boxes black so they would absorb more heat. Those nests were on average 3 to 5 degrees hotter than the unpainted ones. That increase is consistent with the warming expected in the Southwest over the next few decades. The effects were dramatic. The bees raised in warmer conditions were smaller, and they emerged from their nests later in the year, which can impact their ability to find food.
A number of the bees in the warming treatment actually died. They couldn't handle these warmer conditions.
At a time when bees are already stressed, a climate even a few degrees warmer can spell the difference between life and death. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Researchers from the University of Texas at Austin have published a study that shows the popular weed killer glyphosate harms honeybees. When they are exposed to the herbicide, the bees, quote, "lose some of the beneficial bacteria in their guts and are more susceptible to infection and death from harmful bacteria." UT Austin says glyphosate could possibly be indirectly killing bees. In a release statement, they explained, quote, "The researchers exposed honeybees to glyphosate at levels known to occur in crop fields, yards, and roadsides. The researchers painted the bees' backs with colored dots so they could be tracked and later recaptured. When scientists looked at the bees after 3 days of exposure, they were found to have significantly reduced healthy gut bacteria. With current declines in bee populations, this new study could affect companies that sell products containing glyphosate. Monsanto, whose product Roundup contains the weed killer, has continuously denied that it is harmful to bees.
A news release from the Portland Water Bureau on Monday said that no cryptosporidium has been detected in the city's drinking water since April 10th. Small numbers of the parasite has been found in Portland's water since 2017. The Water Bureau has since increased efforts to protect the city's main source of drinking water, the Bull Run Watershed. This includes keeping people out of the watershed, keeping human sewage away from water sources, and increasing inspections of high-risk areas. The state of Oregon also requires the Water Bureau update the public on a quarterly basis. Currently, Portland does not treat its water for cryptosporidium, but is in the process of building a filtration system. The city hopes to have it installed by 2027. Cryptosporidium can cause diarrhea, vomiting, fever, and stomach pain. Most get better without medical treatment, but those with weakened immune systems could face life-threatening illnesses.
And now, we return to KBOO volunteer Tom Flynn's series about aging in Portland, Retired or Rewired. This series was not aired over the past 2 weeks due to the fall membership drive, and we now rejoin Tom at episode 19, which takes a look at the Village Movement. You can find all 20 full-length episodes of Retired or Rewired at kboo.fm/program.
Here's our series on aging in Portland, Retired or Rewired, what it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? This is the 19th episode in KBOO series on what it's like to age in Portland. We call it Retired or Rewired. Today we're talking with Lynn Trainer and Lee Radovich. Lynn was one of the key people in getting the Village Movement off the ground in Portland and making it one of the most successful locations in the nation for this important program. And Lee Radovich is a member of River West Village who volunteers to keep others living at home. She's in her 80s and has lived in her home since 1956. What is the Village Movement? Where did it come from?
So the Village Movement began in 1999 when there was a huge snowstorm in Boston, and a group of longtime residents of the Beacon Hill and Back Bay areas decided that they were going to need help cleaning their roofs and things like that if they were going to stay in their homes. So they explored the idea and they created a nonprofit organization where neighbors would help neighbors stay neighbors. There are 200 villages open across the country and another 150 in development.
So how many villages do we have here in Portland now?
We have 8 villages in the greater Portland metropolitan area. 6 are open and 2 are still in the social phase before they begin offering services. So the villages are, there's Northeast Portland, Southeast Portland. There's one in Inner Northeast North Portland. There's one in Southwest. There's one in Beaverton, one in Western Washington County, which is Alloa, Hillsboro, Forest Grove, and Cornelius. And then the two that are still in development are in Vancouver, Washington, and Lake Oswego, West Lynn.
Is each village distinct from the other ones, or is it just like where they are?
Well, each village has very similar properties in that we all strive to expand the social network within our area. We provide activities, we provide services, but those social activities may change or vary based on the volunteers and the members in each village and what they're interested in.
Right.
So, for example, in Beaverton, they have a group that meets once a month to share life stories. There's a group in North Portland that meets to read plays.
Do you have any groups that meet to drink beer?
Oh, many. Eating is very important.
You've been quiet. What's your village?
Well, I live in River West Village, and it goes from the river clear up to Shoals Ferry Road.
How long have you been in that village?
Oh, we just went live last October to provide services, but they've been meeting for about 3 or 4 years. I have been asked to help out a lady that is confined to a walker. So I have helped with light housekeeping there in her home, and that's lovely. And that's all coordinated through the organization.
Wait, did you tell me you've been in your house for 61 years?
I have been in my home actually since 1956, and I hope that I can be there for a number more years.
Is the primary purpose of the villages to give people the opportunity to stay in their homes?
That's one of the main reasons that people get connected with the village, but also older people like to feel that they're valuable, that they can provide a service. A lot of our villagers enjoy volunteering and helping other people. So that's another good reason. But it is wonderful to feel that you're acquainted with this group of people who have been vetted, they have had background checks, and they're interested in helping other people.
Let me get back to you, Lynn. Are there dues?
Yes, it's a membership organization, and the typical full-service membership is about $45 a month for an individual. And for that, in most of our villages, someone can have up to 3 round-trip rides a week, plus other services, access to all of our social events, and to some a vetted vendor program.
Seems a little pricey. That's like $500 a year, right?
But a lot less than, say, $4,500 to go into assisted care. The associate membership is $25 a month. That gives people the opportunity to be involved in all of our social activities, and you get a tax deduction for that, so it helps establish the village.
I think it's really a bargain. It's just reassuring to know that help is there. And there's a lot of interesting social events that I take part in. We had a potluck at my house a couple weeks ago. It's nice to have these friends.
Is there an overall website,
yes,
Lynn, for the whole entity of the Village Movement here?
Exactly. It's www.villagesnw.org. And you can link to any of the village websites from that master site.
Do you think that the city is doing what it needs to do for the elderly?
I think the city has so many different things to do that they don't have the time to or the resources to delve into that. I think that's one of the reasons that villages are so important. 90% of people, according to an AARP study, really would prefer to age at home. And the resources aren't there, just like we don't have resources for schools and everything. So how are we going to do that? We're going to have to figure that out, because if we wait for government to figure it out, there's going to be a whole lot of people in trouble.
How does one start a village if our listeners are thinking, boy, this might work in my neighborhood in Sullivan's Gulch?
So one of the things we have done here in Portland that's different from the rest of the country is we have just one nonprofit organization, and we're developing all the villages under that one umbrella. And so we have the legal corporate entity already, and we have a process that people can use to become part of the Villages Northwest organization. What is really needed is a core group of about 5 to 10 people, who volunteers, who will shepherd the village during its growth phase, and that takes anywhere from 2 to 4 years.
Lee, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, I think it's just a very reassuring thing to have these wonderful people to rely on in case that I'm not able to manage a number of things.
Lynn Trainer and Lee Radovich, thank you for joining us here at KVU today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In our final episode, we'll be reviewing what we learned in the course of preparing this series. You'll hear from many of the people who are doing what they can to make elderly living easier, and we'll answer the question we posed at the beginning. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? Don't miss that final episode. You've been listening to our series on aging in Portland, retired or rewired. You can listen to any episode in this series or the entire series if you go to kboo.fm and look for the show under my name, Tom Flynn. Thanks for joining us today.
Torrential monsoon rains have caused flash flooding in the northern Indian states of Punjab and Himachal Pradesh. Many districts in the states are affected by the floods and consequent landslides. The rains led to rising river water levels, stranding locals in remote villages. As many as 11 people have already been killed by the floods. On Sunday, a bus was washed away in a town of Manali. The National Disaster Response Force has been dispatched after 19 people had to be rescued from the area. Drier weather is expected over the next few days in central and northern India, but eastern and southern regions are expected to see continued rain.
And now, it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The mayor of South Dakota's second largest city wants to replace an aging Indian Health Service facility. The current hospital is one of several in the region not meeting standards of care. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
Rapid City Mayor Steve Allender is working with the Cheyenne River, Rosebud, and Oglala Sioux tribes to seek approval for a new IHS hospital. Sioux San Hospital is the current Indian Health facility for the area. Officials have closed that hospital's emergency wing. Additionally, Sioux San Hospital has failed to meet standards of care mandated by the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. One goal Mayor Allender and tribal leaders have is to bring the new facility to a more convenient location near Interstate 90 and closer to bus routes, housing, and recruitment opportunities for students from Western Dakota Tech. The tribes passed resolutions earlier this year to approve the effort for a new hospital. Officials also authorized the Tribal Health Board to manage Sioux San Hospital in the short term and a new hospital when built. That move is covered by the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. The Tribal Health Board would handle day-to-day operations while keeping federal funding due to historical treaty obligations. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
Social justice issues facing Alaska Native people is the focus of a gathering this week in Juneau. The First Alaskans Institute is hosting the event with community members, advocates, elders, and tribal leaders. Monday's discussion included honoring and protecting Native women. Two recent cases have impacted the Native community. A 10-year-old girl in Kotzebue went missing and was later found dead. And an Anchorage judge sentenced a man to no jail time after being charged with assaulting a woman. Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes President Richard Peterson says the Alaska Native community has the power to make change, and one step is by going to the polls.
We're sick and tired of it, right? Are you sick and tired of it? Yeah. You know what we can do to change it? We need to vote. These bad judges, they're elected. That power is in us. It's time to unelect them. We have to vote. We have to be the solution, because they're not. We have to put people in there that represent all of us.
The two cases have renewed calls for improvements in law enforcement, the justice system, and public safety across the state. The Social Justice Summit wraps up Tuesday. Meanwhile, officials have charged a 41-year-old man with kidnapping, murder, and sexual abuse of the 10-year-old girl in Kotzebue. Peter Wilson faces 9 charges in connection with her death, Alaska Public Media reports. A funeral was held over the weekend for Ashley Johnson Barr, where hundreds of people showed their support for her family. The Bear's Ears case will continue in Washington, D.C. A federal judge ruled Monday cases involving Bear's Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments will remain there in U.S. District Court. In addition, the Interior Department must alert tribes at least 48 hours before any ground-disturbing activities take place on disputed land. A number of tribes are fighting to protect bears' ears in Utah from development. The cases filed against the Trump administration's revoke and replacement of the national monuments. Five tribes are among those to hold the area sacred, including Ute tribes, the Navajo Nation, Zuni Pueblo, and the Hopi tribe. Attorneys with the Native American Rights Fund say they're eager to move forward with the case and claim the removal of protections of bears' ears is illegal. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 25th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Teresa Mitchell, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Sam Bowman. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bowman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Project Censored presents several speeches from the 2018 Petaluma Progressive Festival, covering issues like housing, immigration, climate change, and nuclear disarmament. At 9, on Political Perspectives, Lisa Loving talks to peace activist Kathy Kelly about colonialism and nonviolence in the face of war. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Recovery Zone talks to the organizers of the 2018 Radical Mycology Convergence for Fungi Lovers, Artists, and Activists. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Good night, Sam. Good night, Kyle.
Good night, Yasmin and Sam.
Good night, both of y'all.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today, KBOO News In Depth features the voice of Joan Gibbs, a radical lawyer and longtime LGBTQIA plus activist. She spoke at this year's Queer Radical Past Conference back in February in Amherst, Massachusetts. This talk previously aired on Out FM, a program on WBAI, a Pacifica station in New York City.
My name is Joan Gibbs. If you read my biography, then you know I'm probably the oldest person up here. Well, I first became involved in the movement in the fall of 1968, in the anti-Vietnam War movement and the anti-racist movement, and have pretty consistently been involved in the movement ever since. Most notably in anti-imperialist and solidarity activities, and the LGBT movement, but probably most intensely in the Black Liberation Movement. There's a reason for that that I won't go into. In 1968 and now, I believe in the necessity of a revolution. And nothing in all the years since then has changed my mind about that. And I say that because, you know, my views have obviously evolved. In 1968, we thought a revolution around the corner, and that wasn't true, so obviously we didn't really understand. But because of what has been going on and what is going on in this country, and the fundamental rights that we lack human beings. And that's why I think a revolution is short is necessary. Now, the election of the last president, because Malcolm X, when learning, studying Malcolm, taught me one thing, would never say our government, like he would say our government is, what, no, the government is trouble, not our government, has, you know, tempered my optimism, but it hasn't extinguished it. So I still believe that one day their revolution will occur, but probably not in my lifetime. Now, I haven't been involved in the movement for a long time. In 1969, I should drop a note here and say I was outed to my mother by my sister in 1971. So I had been out in 1979, roughly 8 years. And I was living in a women's collective, which is made up mostly, mostly lesbians, in the Fort Greene section of Brooklyn. And I'm gonna come back to Fort Greene in the end. Because at the time I was paying $60 a month. Uh-huh. Now if you know anything about Fort Greene, Brooklyn, you know you can't even find a parking space for a bike in Fort Greene, Brooklyn now. I was working at the National Lawyers Guild on one of the other National Lawyers Guild Grand Jury Project, which is one of the other things that I devoted a lot of my time to, which is namely the issue of political repression, where I was talking, educating people about what to do when the FBI comes and knocks on your door, and also about federal grand juries, which at the time were being used to incarcerate people, mostly other leftists and progressives, for refusing to cooperate with these federal grand juries that were looking for, alleged, ostensibly looking for fugitives, mainly former leftists who had been chased or gone on the ground and who had allegedly committed crimes against the United States government, domestic and foreign policy and protests of it. The targets of these grand jurors and the ones that I mainly dealt with at the time were members of the Puerto Rican independence movement, the Black Liberation Movement, and the anti-imperialist allies. These are three, people don't talk too much about Puerto Rican independence, but I still believe in it, notwithstanding the votes in Puerto Rico that had produced contrary results. But I think now what's going on in Puerto Rico after Maria says that definitely they need to be independent, because otherwise, because the United States has basically cast and ignored Puerto Rico. I mean, I assume that time that most people don't know that Puerto Rico, I mean, it's not a state, it's basically, it's a colony. So when people talk, always talk about, oh, let's decolonize. No, we need to decolonize the colony that the U.S. possesses, namely Puerto Rico.
And D.C.
And D.C., oh, right, the other colony, D.C. I went to the march with some sisters who I work with, Azalea Magazine, on. And we, so if you listen to Gil this morning, you know there was a conference at the first march. And so I went to that and I caucused with people. But mainly one of the things that happened there was I met a group of women who, and we got a chance to caucus and network, that later in the year we would come together to form Dykes Against Racism Everywhere. Now, we call ourselves Dykes Against Racism Everywhere because we didn't want to be any ambiguity about who we were, first of all. But secondly, because that we were fighting against racism inside and outside of the lesbian gay community. And the organization was formed in particular because some of us, among them myself, was working on organizing the February, I think it was the February 2nd demonstration in Greensboro, North Carolina, where, as somebody mentioned earlier today, five members of the Commons Workers' Party were gunned down in broad daylight by members of the Klan. So we were organizing this national march, and we decided, oh, we need to get organized for the lesbian and gay community, and then we were tasked with going through it and doing that. I have to say, I should say, that the 1979 march was in many ways more meaningful to me. It was grassroots has already been indicated. But also, you know, the speakers I sort of enjoyed better. There was Flo Kennedy, for example. People know Flo Kennedy, okay. Audre Lorde spoke. Charlotte Bunch, who's still active. And also Allen Ginsberg, who I don't know how you feel about him, but I actually like Allen Ginsberg.
He was my teacher once.
You know? And we were welcomed by Marion Barry. By 87, I guess after all those years attending marches, because by 87, I don't know how many marches I had attended, I can't take any longer long rallies. I have to say, I can't. I can't take speaker after speaker after speaker. I don't care if you interrupt it in the middle with a song by Holly Near, or if you bring in my favorite singer of all time, Joan Baez. It really is standing out in Washington, D.C. for 9 hours. I just can't any longer. Now I have an excuse. I could always go over and say, oh, I'm so old. But I went to the march. By the time of the 1987 march, my life had changed in many respects. I was now a lawyer. I was a lawyer in 1979. I was a lawyer. I was working at the Center for Constitutional Rights, still working on the issues that I work on today. One of the things I was working on, which hasn't been talked about here, was I was working on, we were working on beginning let me see, I'm about to get this right. We were a lawsuit challenging some women who were incarcerated in Lexington, Kentucky, and a prison there. They were left women, among them some lesbians, among them Susan Rosenberg. Mm-hmm. And so we were working on that, and I was also working on some other things having to do with political people. We would, after that, after the march, I would begin to work on the resistance trial in D.C. So, you know, the 1987 march, I think, you know, it should be applauded for broadening the demands, of course, and but we have to also think about the fact that it was a 5-day affair, you know, and that is prohibited to a lot of people. I mean, I don't think I stayed there 5 days because I had to work and I had other responsibilities. But it was important. It was important that one of the reasons I went is because, you know, everybody talked about Reagan today, but I wanted to add one aspect of Reagan that hasn't really been talked about enough. Reagan was one of the most racist presidents that we've had before the current. Uh-huh. Reagan began his campaign in Mississippi, like 7 miles from where Cherna, Swerner, and Goodman were killed in Philadelphia, Mississippi, okay? So Reagan, and so that atmosphere is what, you know, for me, the thing that I was most, and one of the things I was most concerned with, as well as his complete and blatant, just ignoring the AIDS, what we then called the AIDS crisis and the people who were dying from it. And so that is something that, you know, we have to whoever said, you know, people don't understand about the AIDS crisis. And I always think one of the things, I was eventually became one of ACT-UP's lawyers, but one of the things that happened in my personal life during this period was that every black gay male friend that I had died, every one of them. I don't really have that many now because I lost so many at the time, including one of my roommates. So I don't know. I guess I'm going to go. I'm running out of time. How many minutes do I have?
I was just going to say, okay. You can wrap it up.
Okay, I'll wrap it up. And I'll wrap it up by saying that I hope we have a chance to talk about what we should be doing now.
Yep. Right on.
It's nice to know I'm a student of history. I love reading history. But really what it's important about being together to figure out and talk about what we're going to do now in the face of what I believe is one of the most dangerous rulers of the United States that has existed in my lifetime. Okay, thank you. I'm going to stop.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Whiskey Dixie and the Big Wet Country, playing now through October 13th at the Imago Theater in Portland. Whiskey Dixie and the Big Wet Country is a raunchy outlaw country musical about a sexually frustrated cowgirl on a tragic comic ride from hell who will do whatever it takes to get off. Written by local award-winning and Grammy-nominated songwriter Amanda Richards and directed by Sarah Pope, this off-color comedy offers a feminist perspective into a world of dive bars, drunks, and country music. Again, that's Whiskey Dixie and the Big Wet Country, playing now through October 13th at Imago Theater, 17 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Warning, the following message is only for listeners who contributed during KBOO's fall membership drive. If you did not contribute to KBOO's fall membership drive, please turn off your radio now.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's fall membership drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
If you didn't contribute during KBOO's fall membership drive, you may now turn your radio back on.
It's not too late. Go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution right now.
Then the next time this spot plays, you'll be able to listen.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and next up we have Hedda with Preference.